From the Sky News Centre at 6. Theresa May says the UK will have more talks with the EU over the coming days as she tries to tweak her deal so MPs approve it in the new year. European leaders say they won't reopen negotiations, but she says she wants further assurances. Earlier, the PM was filmed talking sternly to European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, who says it was all a misunderstanding.
I was not addressing her, and in the course of the morning, after having checked what I said yesterday night, she was kissing me.
Meanwhile, Tony Blair is urging Mrs. May to change course because he believes her Brexit deal won't get MPs' support. The former PM thinks the time has come for a second referendum.
We've had 30 months of negotiation. There is no real consensus as to what form of Brexit people want. And the deal that the Prime Minister's finally concluded with Europe is a deal that no one really wants. So I think the logical thing is to go back to the people and say, you're going to have to give us direction.
French authorities say a fourth person has died after Tuesday's Christmas market terror attack in Strasbourg. The gunman was shot dead by police last night. A major climate change conference is wrapping up in Poland with no real agreement. The American delegation is being accused of being completely out of step with other nations. A statue of suffragette Emmeline Pankhurst has been unveiled in her home city of Manchester by her great-granddaughter 100 years after women first voted. It's the first statue of a woman to be built in Manchester since Queen Victoria in 1901. It was sculpted by Hazel Reeves.
Emmeline, I'm so sorry. Your statue has been a long, long time coming. Exactly 100 years since you proudly first placed your ballot paper into that box.
And former Chancellor George Osborne has taken up his ninth job since leaving the government. The Evening Standard editor has joined his brother's Silicon Valley firm. That's the latest. I'm Daisy Gray.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem Councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. To France after the 7 o'clock news, where President Macron goes on to TV to call for calm. And what does he get? Four dead at the Strasbourg Christmas market and no questions asked about the so-called killer. Gendarmes say they called out to Sheriff Chakat, but he was shot. He shot first, so they then shot him dead. And the China-Canada tit-for-tat started by Washington, kidnapping each other's top executives. Is this Trump's hardball trade negotiation tactic with the Chinese, just as he spells out in his book, The Art of the Deal? And nearly 10,000 electronic voting machines are torched in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which looks set to delay their presidential elections even further than the 2 years it's already been delayed. And we go to the belly of the beast and ask a retired Lloyds banker how the banks became the banksters and what we and our politicians need to do to put them back in the box. Plus, Martin Summers has his chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 1 Celsius and a little windy. This weekend, highs of 10 Celsius, wet and windy over the weekend. Next week is highs of 11, still staying quite well away from freezing. Some sunny spells and showers, but also windy next week. Next weekend, it's the 22nd and 23rd of December. Highs around 9 Celsius, light rain and a moderate breeze. The week after next, around Christmas, highs around 9 Celsius and over the holidays, some sunny spells. Get out and have a nice bracing walk. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem Councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. And Gary, we've also had news from the Lib Dems again about the full council meeting on Tuesday, rather inadequate questions to answers rather from the mayor about more questions you're asking about bungs. I mean, I can call them that, I think, given to just £100,000 of our money given to the Marvin's first chief executive, who then left of her own accord.
Yes, I mean, the thing is that if he'd actually been upfront about this whole situation at the beginning, he wouldn't really have a problem, the mayor, but he does have a massive problem now because he's misled council, he's attempted to mislead the public, and I'm afraid nobody's believing a word he's saying.
What about, I mean, if he's doing that, surely this you start to come close to misleading, a politician should not be doing this, especially an elected mayor. Is there anything you can do legally?
Well, it is possible. One thing that was quite interesting was that he tried to portray in the accounts that the money...
Well, to be fair, he didn't prepare the accounts, did he? It would have probably been Craig Cheney or somebody like that.
Well, you know, he's responsible for everything that this administration puts out. That's what the mayor's system's about.
That's where the buck stops.
Exactly. And basically, they tried to put out that she'd been paid just part of her normal pay as per the previous arrangements. And the auditors said no, that's untrue, and actually said, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to change that to, she was given effectively a bung. They didn't say a bung, obviously, they're auditors, but basically that's what they said. And now he's just trying to blame the auditors, saying they've got it wrong.
So what's new this week?
Well, questions were asked by one of our members who has actually got a petition up again about this subject and has been worrying away at it for quite some while. And strangely, his questions didn't get printed out the right way, and he was forced to remove the name of Klonowski from his questions, which is bizarre because everyone knew exactly what they were all about. And I think that he said that written version of his questions wasn't made available to the public.
This question actually was supposed to have been on the papers for November, wasn't it?
I don't know when Graham originally submitted it, but
is what he said. He submitted it for that deadline.
I'm sure if he said that's the case, then basically that will be the case. They're having a lot of difficulty trying to keep this under wraps, and of course possibly they gave some excuse that it was going to be looked at by audit committee and by the auditors, and of course it has been looked at by the audit committee now, and they're very unhappy about it, and the auditors refused to sign off the accounts until the description was changed.
Well, let me quote Graham, because he says, when I asked the mayor what lessons might be learnt in the recruitment and management of senior officers from this whole debacle, we were treated to a speech about how much he had improved the city council's governance and management. I do wonder if he's living in a parallel universe.
Well, I think so too, because when I actually I put questions to him, and he claimed that I was campaigning against the position of mayor, against the wishes of the public. So I actually produced an opinion poll that we'd done a lot of research on across Bristol, which showed that 65% of people would actually vote to get rid of position of mayor if they wanted to. He's in a parallel universe.
I mean, this is a tactic that internet trolls use, isn't it? Where you ask a question, a specific question about something specific, then they'll try and personalise it. They'll say things like, oh yes, but actually this is about you, Gary, not about the question you're asking.
Well, I mean, I've been having that for quite some months, and every time he insults me, I get more and more people flocking to my side. The argument, so let him carry on. It's not doing him any good.
Also, could you take us through your budget meeting today? I know it was not actually open to the public. OSM. Tell us what OSM is. And this is, just to give people an idea of what people like you get up to.
Overview and Scrutiny Management. And most meetings of OSM are open to the public, but today was a planning meeting because we're trying to piece together, because there will be short time to do it in the public meetings, the areas of the budget that we need to be looking at and examining, and examining in public.
So what are they? What are the things going to be coming
Well,
out?
There's quite a bit of worry about...
I mean, the budget, obviously, is being cut year on year on year, isn't it? We just heard this week also that the police are going to be given permission to actually ask for more money from council tax because of the increase in violent crime and the lack of police available because of all the cuts.
Yeah, I mean, the The thing that we were specifically really looking at was, we know that services have been squeezed down, but we're looking at, is the planning there? Are they in a position where they know what they're doing? In other words, are they set on a budget that can actually be hit? And in a couple of areas, that hasn't worked out very well indeed. We are concerned about the adult social care budget, because that's, you know, again, come out way different to what was actually planned.
And so, hang on. Let's just pin on that for a second, yeah. Because you're talking about the actual spending being much higher than is in the budget?
Yes, that's not unique to the last year or so. That's been happening for a few years. But basically, we think that they probably knew it when they set the budget they weren't going to be able to stick to it. And that's quite a worrying position.
Well, it's extremely worrying because some of these people are very vulnerable. And actually, yes. When you get to the point where an adult is in need of social care, quite often that person cannot jump through all the hoops necessary to fight to get an assessment, that sort of thing, and they really rely on family, on others around them to help them to actually do that, to make sure that they do get an assessment. What I've seen from other parts of the country and here is that often the council officers are reluctant to actually have an assessment, knowing that they haven't got actually enough money to pay for all the people that are in the queue.
Yeah, we haven't really got the proof on that in adult social care. It was certainly the case with special needs children. That was absolutely the case, and there was some illegal information being given to parents there. We've been denied the right to get assessments illegally. So we know it's happening there. We haven't yet got evidence of that happening in adult social care.
It may not be illegal, but what the councils seem to have been doing around the country is just simply, for example, losing bits of paper, not opening emails, this sort of thing, in order to, so that the clock doesn't start ticking. Because once the council gets a request to assess somebody, they've got to start the process, and they've got a limited time to do that. The only thing is that ticking clock only starts once you've opened the letter, once you've registered the letter on the system, or once you've opened the email.
Yes, that is a concern. That wasn't specifically what we were looking at this afternoon, because what we were looking at this afternoon was the fact that in Bristol, the cost for each individual person looked after, and these were pre-retirement, was higher than practically anywhere else in the UK, which means for a given budget, you're actually helping less people. And at the moment, there isn't a clear explanation as to why the costs are significantly higher in Bristol than elsewhere.
I suppose the answer has got to be, are these, or at least one of the questions has got to be, are all these farmed out services to charities and other non-council bodies?
Well, it's a mixture, really. It's a mixed market there. But the thing that's concerning, to me in any event, is that they don't actually seem to know why it costs more. And that's the first point when you're looking at accounts that you've got to start worrying. If people don't know why they're spending more than others are spending to provide a similar service.
There doesn't seem to be any particular reason why it should cost more to look after somebody in Bristol than anywhere else in, say, in southern England?
Well, it would cost more than, somewhere in the north of England for property costs, that sort of thing. Wages tend to be a bit higher. But it wasn't that sort of factor. We were basically higher than anywhere else. And that was a worry.
It certainly is, Martin, isn't it? It does sound as if we're not getting as many bangs for our buck here in Bristol as people are in other parts of the country.
Well, that may or may not be so. I don't know. I hear what's being said. I think the real problem that we're facing is that by 2020, when we're moving to no central government grants at all for local government, all that local government will be able to do is adult social care and special needs children. There won't be anything else. But basically, local government as we have known it is basically in the knacker's yard. It's like boxer being sent to the meat factory.
Well, you're talking about a consultation as well, I know, at the City Council over this budget, the 2019-2020 budget, Gary. I notice a rapturous reception to Bristol City Council's tweet announcing the Bristol budget consultation with a grand total of zero retweets and zero likes. This came out on the 12th of December, so no one seems to even notice that there's a consultation going on. Is there any point in doing this if people aren't actually specifically given, you know, a consultation that is just on Twitter, that there's nobody has even noticed on Twitter? Doesn't seem to be like much of a consultation.
No. I agree. Then again, I mean, which is worse, the non-consultation about nothing or the misleading consultation where you're given three answers, none of which you like? And the consultations that the council are putting out over the last few years seem to vary between those two. The other factor that's extremely concerning about the budget planning is that we've, so say, got a medium-term financial plan, but although there are pressures there that they say are going to need addressing, which will need addressing because the budget over a few years isn't balancing, there's going to be no attempt really to balance that up next year, this year or next year, because of course the year after that, when they are planning to address it, is after the elections in 2020. So basically things have been put off till after then.
Well, whoever Anna Klonowski's been employing and the whole sort of command chain, it looks to me a little bit suspect, because the language that the communications people at the council are using with this consultation, Martin, they go right the way through it. They're saying, oh, we're making some great savings. Savings. There's no mention of cuts at all.
Well, I think that's my main objection to the direction that the council's taking, is they're trying to put lipstick on a pig. And it's not just in Bristol, across the country. Northamptonshire, as we know, has gone bankrupt. North Somerset is about to go bankrupt. All local authorities are going to go bankrupt in the
long run. Is this deliberate, then?
Of course it is. It's central government policy to kill off local government. I mean, they've taken the schools off local government. They'll be left with the Cinderella services of adult social care and special needs children, both of which are terribly important. I'm not saying they're not, but they won't have any resources for anything else, and they won't even be able to fulfil their statutory duties on that.
Will there be a budget left for you to manage by the time that you get your referendum to get rid of the mayor position and our local councils get a little bit of power back again?
Well, I suspect, I mean, these things tend to go in waves, don't they? We've had a lot of centralisation and squeezing down on local government. I think that there's a general acceptance in Whitehall now that things have gone far too far and that we might get a little bit of easing up. So we will be looking to get rid of the mayor. And I think, see, as well as the actual real squeeze, we've also got desperate inefficiencies within the city council. Money is being spent on things which just don't make any sense.
Give us a couple of examples, yeah.
Right, we're paying £1,500 a day for somebody who's on, who refuses to sign a long-term contract to the council because he's far better off being paid on that basis, who actually gave very, very questionable advice with regard to cancelling the arena.
Just one example. Any more examples? People who you think are overpaid, money that's being wasted?
Well, I mean, we had to send back nearly £300,000 to central government of money that was needed for children, looked after children, for their education, because the plans hadn't been made on how to spend it. So it had to be sent back to government. You know, quite a lot of money.
And also, let me add my two halfpence, is they're not spending enough money looking after our pavements, even in the city centre. I was walking past Primark the other day. It was like going through the haunted house, a fairground. The paving stones rocking from side to side. You have to really quite put your arms out to keep balance to actually just walk down the street.
Yeah, well, there's huge amounts of bits and pieces of work going on the street, but half the time, it's difficult to work out what's being done. And large amounts of money are being spent, but sometimes it's quite difficult to see what's being achieved.
Now, I remember back in the old days, they used to actually take the whole business of paving stones quite seriously. The idea, if the paving stone is sticking up, you trip on it and fall, that the council would be liable.
They still are liable.
Okay, folks, remember that. If one of these paving slabs... Okay, great tip, Gary. If you trip up on one of these haunted house paving slabs around Primark near the bus stops and around there, that whole area, it's just been left. It's almost like you've got subsidy under the ground, but nobody at the council's noticed.
Well, I don't know about that individual situation, but basically if the council's left pavement in a dangerous state and people trip over, or the same thing would happen with somebody riding a bike and getting into a nasty rut or whatever, then and injure themselves, the council's liable.
Simple as that. Martin, what do you make of the... I mean, it's a sort of lack of maintenance, isn't it? It's like that's the maintaining things. Looking after stuff is right on the back burner now. It's only, I suppose, prestige projects that are being looked at nowadays.
Well, I think what the problem is, the prestige projects is the problem. I mean, they should be focusing on their main core stuff. But as I said before, where we're going is a situation where local authorities will only have the resources to do their statutory stuff. There will be no discretionary spending at all, and they won't even be able to fulfil that. That's what's happened in Northamptonshire. They can't fulfil even what they're statutorily obliged to do.
You know, I thought you were going to say there, actually, these paving stones can be quite handy if you get a Yellow Jacket-style situation.
Well, they're not a proper pavé. French pavé are just hand-sized to throw. These things are a bit too heavy for that. You've got to break them up first, like they used to do in Northern Ireland.
Sound like a seasoned campaigner.
Mm.
Homeless pods designed to keep rough sleepers alive in the cold and safe from street violence have been denied funding. These have been designed over in Newport, and there was an expectation that they would be rolled out in South Wales and then used in all other parts of the country. But apparently, although lots of other measures for the homeless have been approved, Gary, the idea of having pods, which cost a few thousand pounds each in order to keep people safe, is not something that the councils are interested in. Do you think there's any reason for that?
Don't know.
This is South Wales, to be fair.
Yeah. Well, things are done differently there than here. But on the face of it, they sound like a reasonable idea, but it's where you put them is one of the things, isn't it? Because people, you know, gravitate to certain areas. Would people really be safe inside?
Well, I can
them?
Tell you where they are over Newport. It looks to me as if this is a part of an old shopping centre, which is kind of mostly derelict, but along the front of the empty shops, there are various pods. There's about three or four of them sitting there that homeless people can get in. At least it means that they're... I mean, we saw this hideous bit of footage during the week. I don't know if you saw that up in Hull, with people doing drop kicks on a tent of homeless living in Hull. Imagine smacking people on the shoulders, in the head, because they're vulnerable and living in a tent. Now, this would at least protect against that sort of thing, and also it means people aren't going to die of cold.
Well, anything that can give protection is certainly going to be seriously looked at and considered. I don't know the details, and so I can't say whether it's a scheme that will work or not.
They cost £5,000 each, Martin. I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the homeless pods. I mean, we talked about the tent city, do you remember, when we were saying that people at this administration, Marvin's administration, were saying, but these homeless people are defecating. Well, I said, well, why not just put a port-a-loo in there? Oh, no, we can't afford that.
Well, I think the ongoing scandal of homelessness in this country is, you know, we're getting used to it now, but we shouldn't be used to it. People should be raging against this, and whatever measures need to be taken should be taken, because it's absolutely unacceptable what's going on.
Okay, also Universal Credit, whilst we're on that subject, wonderful Universal Credit. This is universally discredited is one of the hashtags, which is a good one to follow if you want to find out what's going on with Universal Credit. Leaves applicants scavenging in bins at night for food, a torturous process to sign up, interminable wait without money after it, and vulnerable applicants sidelined. A new report highlights the human fallout of the new payment system being inflicted on the country. That's the Daily Mirror. And I like the choice of that phrase, inflicted, Martin. This is a kind of new poor law, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I think the basic design flaws of it have been clear from the get-go. Ian Duncan Smith...
Well, some might say those were designed into it deliberately.
Yes, I was just about to say that. Ian Duncan Smith insisted that there should be the previous system was based on the idea if somebody's had a misfortune, a redundancy or an illness or whatever, the last thing you want them to do is them to lose their accommodation. So immediately the system kicked in to pay their rent, to keep them to keep them stable, so that they could then sort out whatever the problem was. But this whole policy has been that you've got to wait 6 and then they reduce it to 5 weeks before you get a penny. And of course, for people like Ian Duncan Smith, who've got money to burn, that wouldn't bother them. They just borrow the money, or they just use their savings. But of course, poor people haven't got any savings, so they're immediately in arrears. And of course, the private sector landlords won't rent to people if they know they're on universal credit, because they know they're going to be in arrears straight away, which is why homelessness has massively increased wherever they've tried to bring it, run it out, which is why it's not been run out. It takes 6 years to run out, because every time they run it out, they immediately increase the homelessness. And that's designed into it. And everybody's been telling the government this, Shelter, all these people have been telling them from the get-go, you shouldn't do it like they shouldn't. But Ian Duncan Smith is absolutely determined, no, it shouldn't be too easy to get it. Shouldn't be too easy to get it, otherwise everybody will want it. And of course, that's completely the wrong attitude towards welfare. It's just wrong. And it could easily be changed. They could just, by a stroke of a pen, go back to the old system where we pay from day one that you make the claim.
Actually, Gary...
And pay the landlords directly.
Gary,
but they won't do it.
This is your wonderful austerity policy you organised with David Cameron back in 2010, isn't it?
Well, in actual fact, universal credit, the principle of it, was actually agreed to by all parties. The problem is the way it's actually been rolled out. The tragedy is something that could have been good has now been totally discredited, and it means that we will not get a proper integrated benefit system operating because it's been done so badly.
Would you subscribe to the deliberate or not? Is this an accident, or is it deliberately punitive?
I think from some people it's been deliberately punitive. I think some people who've been implementing it don't quite realise the consequences of it because they've never been there themselves.
On to the inevitable Brexit. Big subject this week. Prime Minister just about manages to survive, even though she's still a kind of zombie walking around, going backwards and forwards to all the European countries trying to get deals, getting nowhere. Because, Martin, you posted me this story. The hedge funds are making big bets against the post-Brexit UK economy. The hedge funds have made million-pound bets against the high street as Brexit uncertainty threatens the UK economy. Now, we've heard several shops this week, I think, was it Debenhams and several others, in trouble, maybe haven't actually hardly made any money out of the Christmas rush. Everyone's buying stuff online and or, by the way, and this is quite a big one, they're just not spending as much at Christmas as they used to.
Well, I think that particular article is interesting because a lot of the big hedge fund pro-Brexit people who basically gave money, I can't remember the names of them all, they are betting that the basically Brexit is going to be a catastrophe. And of course, as we saw on Wednesday, when the Prime Minister survived, the pound basically picked up a bit. And as we move towards a no-deal Brexit...
Haven't you been pushing for this catastrophe, so-called catastrophe?
No, I haven't been pushing for anything. I'm just objectively pointing out what's going on.
Predicting it for 10 years.
Well, of course, but it only happens... the thing about falling off a building, it only happens once, yeah? You've climbed to the top of the building and you haven't fallen off yet, but when you do fall off, you fall off and you fall all the way down. And of course, it doesn't happen till it happens, and when it happens, it happens. Like the Grenfell fire, it only happens once. And of course, it's predictable once you put the cladding on. Yeah, you see what I mean?
So do you think the high street is going to be okay if we don't have Brexit?
No, I think the real problem, but the other thing that they don't mention, that the hedge funds have to tell when they're taking short positions on things like companies. They have to basically, you know, say they've taken a short position, but they don't have to say whether they're taking a short position on the currency markets. And so you've got the ridiculous spectacle of people like John Redwood and Jacob Rees-Mogg, who I believe we're going to hear from shortly, who are in their other lives are hedge fund managers, and they are betting that Brexit will be a disaster. And of course, there's plenty of money to be made as long as you get that right.
Isn't Theresa May's husband, Philip?
Her husband, yeah.
Yeah, he's also one of these. And he's a big investor in Lockheed Martin and Amazon.
That's right.
Starbucks.
And of course, the things he invests in, when they did the so-called chemical weapons attack airstrike on Syria, the pillow talk between him and Theresa May the night before meant so that he can then go out and take the right position on his share portfolio the following morning. It's insider trading by any other definition, but it happens all the time and it's the norm, I'm afraid. We've seen this in the US, where Senator Inouye this week, he knew that there was going to be an increase in defence spending, so his broker bought extra shares in Raytheon and then sold them for a profit because he was inside knowledge of what Trump had agreed. So, and that goes on all the time, it's just normal stuff.
So, Gary, do you think we're going to start seeing places like the galleries? I mean, I noticed they've got this year the first charity shop appeared in the galleries. Are these places going to be emptying? That's certainly what this article seems to be predicting.
There's a huge amount of pressure on retail. That's actually a very hot topic in my ward at the moment, in actual fact. Broadwalk Shopping Centre, which does cheap very well, and lots of people travel to it because it's a good place to buy cheap food, etc., and other day-to-day items, but it needs a wider variety of shops. And actually, it's been losing money for quite some while, and actually been in administration. And developers have come along. They want to invest money, but they want to build flats on the back of it. And basically, that the general scheme is absolutely necessary. Otherwise, we could have, you know, a lot of shops being boarded up and going down the tubes. So the scheme is wanted, but most people don't actually realise how much threat there actually is to our local shopping
centre. The other thing we're losing is pubs as well, isn't it? Basically, almost all of these are public spaces that we're losing, of one sort or another. Even retail space effectively is public space.
Well,
can I just say on that context that this is the way a property market collapses, yeah? Because the retailers basically owe loads of money to, you know, the physical infrastructure is all borrowed. And, of course, that at that point, that brings down the economy.
Oh, that's a nice...
it's just factual stuff.
Cheery bit of Christmas cheer.
There's bound to be, not just because of Brexit, there is bound to be pain ahead because of everything that's been done wrong over the last 10 years. There's no way out of it.
OK, Gary, what do you make of events this week with the vote of confidence in Theresa May? I suppose we should really, first of all, say something about the pulling of Tuesday's vote, because that was extraordinary.
Well, utterly ridiculous, isn't it?
I just better explain. There was a vote on Tuesday over Theresa May's wonderful Brexit deal that... Most commentators, including on this programme, we've been saying for the last month, you'll not get, or 3 weeks at least, there's no way that this deal is going to get through Parliament. And literally 2 days before, or the day before, Theresa May comes to the House of Commons to say, oh, actually, you know, we've had 3 days of debate, but you know what, I don't think we should vote because it would make me look bad.
Yeah, well, put it this way, she's now off to Brussels to try and get some adjustments, clarifications. It's not going to make any difference at all. And the reason for that is that there's a majority of people who are absolutely determined that she will fail. Labour are absolutely determined that her deal cannot go through because they want a general election. And the Brexiteers in her own party are absolutely determined it can't go through because they do not want a compromise Brexit. They want out. And they don't want any connections to the EU at all. So basically, the numbers there between them actually mean that she cannot win.
But she surely can, Gary, if she's got the DUP and her Brexiteers on side, and there is some sort of that is just about possible to do.
Yeah, but, I mean, the
Irish, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they're going to be quite difficult about things, but not as difficult as the Brexiteers might actually be. With the DUP, it is possible she might bring something back that might persuade them, but with the Rees-Moggs of this world, they do not want a deal. They do not want to have a compromise.
Well, anyway,
they're happy to bring the government down and to have a position where we move towards chaos.
Well, we'll hear from Martin after we hear from good old William Rees-Mogg. You just mentioned there, and here he is talking about the backstop and how important that is.
And
that
you can't negotiate with a rattlesnake.
Given that she won't be able to get rid of the backstop, what else might placate you?
Well, then we leave without a deal and the European Union doesn't get its £39 billion that it needs, particularly in the 21 months remaining of the multi-annual financial framework. And this creates serious problems for the EU because either Germany will have to pay more or Poland will have to receive less. So it would be a real hole in the European Union's budget, money that we are willing to pay if the EU offers us a sensible deal.
Of course, there's another option, which is stopping Article 50.
Well, yes, of course there is. We could just ignore all democracy and install a dictatorship. But it would be a really shocking approach to take when 17.4 million voted to leave. And it's really interesting talking to people. People are saying, I didn't vote for a deal, I voted to leave. And it's leaving that has to be delivered upon, and that means being out of the customs union, out of the single market, out of the European court, and not paying them large amounts of money. All the things Theresa May used to promise, that's what she has to deliver on.
So basically what he's saying there at the start is, Martin, is that if Theresa May can get rid of the backstop, then she's got the DUP and his support.
Yeah, well, the backstop isn't. It isn't within her. The backstop has been imposed by the EU and the Irish. You can't make it go away by convincing the DUP are discussing this afternoon with the Labour leadership whether they will support a vote of no confidence next week. As I understand their position, they just want the what happens in Northern Ireland to be the same as what happens in the rest of Britain, and therefore there's some wriggle room in their position, but. Yeah, I mean, they could have a no-deal Brexit, but they've got to let the Irish go. In other words, the Irish will have to have... The Irish government and the EU, don't forget, in the six counties, they voted to remain in the EU, and they're saying, well, you can have what you want, but you've got to exclude Ireland from it. But the DUP could just be washed... You know, if she hadn't called that general election and lost her overall majority, it wouldn't matter what the DUP thought about that. Because it would, but unfortunately, it does.
So give us your crystal ball, Mystic Meg, for next week then.
Well, what will happen next week? We've got to decide whether she's going to come back next week. I mean, the Labour Party pushing, we'll come back and have the vote next week. There's no point waiting till the new year. Because what her strategy is she's going to wait till the last minute. Then, of course, she loses the vote, and then you go into a no-deal Brexit by default, yeah? Because there's no time to discuss anything else. But, of course, the Labour Party, if she does try to do that, there'll be a no-confidence vote will be tabled at some point. And the question is, will there be enough dissenters to bring the government down, and that's actually debatable whether she could survive that. And of course, if she doesn't survive it, there's a general election. If she does survive it, which she probably will, you then move to a situation where discussions are already underway between Tory moderates, all the opposition parties, about going for a second referendum, which will be the only because what Dominic Grieve's amendment already means that a no deal Brexit there isn't a majority in Parliament or the country for a no deal Brexit, and that's going to be ruled out. So, in other words, what the Brexiteers are doing here is playing double or quits. If they don't want this Brexit, maybe they ain't getting any Brexit at all, because it's like a game of poker.
Before we hear from Gary, let's have a listen to the Daily Mail's Quentin Letts, who had quite a, I suppose, fiery reaction to and rather dismissive of Theresa May's not allowing this vote to take place on Tuesday when she came to the House of Commons to announce there would be no vote on Monday.
Mrs May's still there, the old dead donkey, and she's a bit of a blockage in the works, I think, and I think it would be better for the country if she went. Be better for the Tory party, certainly, but who's really worried about the Tories? But she's there, and she's going off to see the Europeans, and they're going to probably not give her anything, but she'll pretend that there's something there, then she'll come back and she'll lose again. There is an element of farce here, with a parliament that is refusing to obey the referendum command that it's been given by the electorate, and a whole parliamentary class that's wriggling, desperately trying to find ways of not doing exit from Europe. And what's going to happen? Well, Alex Shelbrook said that he thinks no deal is possibly going to happen. I think no deal is a completely bogus term, because no deal suggests that their departure on no agreement on anything, and that's rubbish, it's just not going to happen. So if they could find another way of describing no deal, call it facilitated departure, say, then I think the MPs would jump at it. You get basic agreement on aircraft landing procedures and passports and medicines, all of which are going to happen. Then I think the British people certainly would love that, but Parliament is going to just have to swallow it. Mm. Parliament has been given a command by the British people and is refusing to do it.
We've now had 3 days of debate on the withdrawal agreement, setting out the terms of our departure from the EU and the political declaration setting out our future relationship after we have left. I've listened very carefully to what has been said in this chamber and out of it. What has been said in this chamber and out of it by members from all sides.
It's ludicrous. Everyone knows she hasn't been listening. And you can't get away with such blatant doublespeak in the House of Commons, because people just mock you. And I'm afraid that's what happened yesterday. She didn't like it much. It was like watching one of those Attenborough programmes on BBC when you see some poor little baby hippo slowly, its slow demise, possibly at the, some predator takes it. Parliament is a theatre, and it is politics made flesh. And yesterday was highly dramatic. Inaction has never been so dramatic as it was yesterday.
Let's listen to Anna Soubry, Tory Remainer, of course.
The thing that is changing is the view of the British people.
No, it's not. It's
wrong. I know it's nearly the pantomime season, but oh yes, it has.
Oh, she deserved that.
That could have gone on for a very long time. Well, mercifully, it didn't, but it could have done.
Subri was twitching away yesterday. I'm afraid there are some people who are just not facing up to what the people voted for on the 23rd of June 2016, and Subri's one of those, and there are plenty more of them in Parliament. It is amazing to see a Parliament so out of step with the British people. And, you know, people draw comparisons with the Civil War, you know, back in Cromwellian days, and saying, you know, Parliament represents the people. The trouble is, it doesn't anymore. Parliament now represents the boss class, and that's why we're in this trouble, because the boss class are refusing to do what they've been told by the electorate.
Gary, the hippo lives on, though, because on Wednesday, Theresa May survived a confidence vote by her own MPs by two-thirds. Although, if you actually have a look at the numbers, as several commentators have reminded us, two-thirds of her backbenchers voted against her.
It's irrelevant. It's the parliamentary arithmetic that actually counts. And basically, as I said before, there is no majority for Brexit with no deal. There is no majority for pushing her deal through. So at the end of it, basically, she is trying to frame the argument two choices, either my deal or hard Brexit. Well, when her deal falls again, which it will do, then basically the choice will be hard Brexit or second referendum. And I think I know which way Parliament will go then. And it's actually amazing when you actually listen to the likes of Quentin Letts talking about why can't they face up to the way that people actually voted. Well, people did vote that way then. But now, if you look at all the opinion polls, you'll find that they've moved very dramatically against Brexit. They have. And, well,
Before you carry on, because I've got to say, the opinion polls pre the Brexit vote were for it to go the other way, for it to go Remain, weren't they?
They were very marginal.
No, they're not marginal now.
There's a very, very significant majority of people said a mistake was made. And actually, a very good point was made by the head of the TUC, I forget her name now, where she actually said, you have a strike vote, the leaders then go off to negotiate with the management, and then if they don't like it, they go back and say, right, what are we going to do? And that's basically the situation we're in now. It was very like a strike vote. You know, we're prepared to go out and strike, and then the negotiations have happened, and negotiations, everybody from all sides agreed, have been a mess. So basically, what do we do now?
So how did we get into this mess in the first place? Well, a lot of people don't realise that this is actually the second referendum we've had on the EEC,
yep,
or on Europe, as they call it. Of course, it's not actually Europe, it's the EEC or the European Union. The history of it was, back in 1973, Conservative Prime Minister Edward Heath signed us into the EEC, and it's a fascinating sort of diametrically opposed parallel, if that makes any geometrical sense, Martin. But back in 1975, we had a similar sort of situation. Rather than the Tories now, it was Labour who had a civil war going on within their party as to which way to vote. And I thought what we'd do is we'd go back, and we'll hear from you in a minute, but we'll go back now to 1973 and have a listen to Edward Heath, who was the Prime Minister who signed us into the European Union in 1973, explaining to a certain extent why he decided to do that without a referendum and why he didn't think a referendum was necessary.
When I first discussed all of this with Jean Monnet in 1960, when I first was asked by Mr. Macmillan to start exploring the possibilities, I went and talked to Jean Monnet, and we went over the whole field, and he said, you people in Britain, you've always been worried about sovereignty. Now, I must tell you this, that if one of the members of the community has something which it regards as vital, the others are not going to overrule it. And why? Because they know it would break up the community. And they don't want to break up the community, because all the other benefits are so great.
Well, one of those vital things might be considered, Martin, keeping the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland together. That seems to be something that Brussels doesn't want to do.
Well, that's a rather bizarre take on what Edward Heath said there, if you don't mind me saying so.
Surely it's a vital interest that Britain actually stays as Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and we don't start use this referendum as a way of splitting up Great Britain.
Well, as a lifelong Irish Republican supporter, I'm obviously not going to agree with you there, Tony, am I? And the fact is that the constitutional position is absolutely clear. Edward Heath took us into the European Union, or EEC as it then was, and there was no referendum because the British Constitution doesn't have... We haven't got a written constitution, and there's no... referendums are advisory in the British Constitution as unwritten. And that's just the facts. And, of course, the Northern Ireland, with the Good Friday Agreement, is not, in fact, fully part of the United Kingdom because there has to be a cross-party, or rather cross-community agreement about everything, apart from in this case. But, of course, the Loyalists didn't win the referendum vote in Northern Ireland. Moderate Loyalist opinion was in favour of, and the business community were in favour of staying in the EU. And, of course, the Brexit ultras in Britain could have everything they want, but they can't enforce it in Ireland, because Ireland's a different country with a different history and tradition.
Well, they could in Northern Ireland.
No, they couldn't, because there's already an agreement with the Irish government about called the Good Friday Agreement, which stopped the Civil War.
Well, we just have to agree.
And a real Civil War, not the pretend
thing that is possibly going to split up the UK is if we push ahead with Brexit, because basically people in Northern Ireland are actually now, it's been shown, far more likely to agree to United Ireland if they're isolated across there and the UK gets out of Europe.
We shall see. Okay, well, let's have a listen now to... Let's have a listen now to a bit more from Ted Heath talking about EEC political and monetary union.
One question in the mind of many Germans is, will England strengthen the camp of those who are in favour of making the central institutions of Europe stronger, or will it rather strengthen the camp of those who favour the national institutions and the national approach within Europe?
Well, you see, I think this is an out-of-date argument. And I've always said that the argument about, on the political side, whether you're going to, whether we now, all of us, are going to have a political federation or confederation is a sterile argument. And surely everything is showing that all the members of the community are moving towards a closer relationship, for example, in the monetary questions. Now, everybody accepts that there ought to be a much closer relationship. There's been a setback because of the measures of August 15th with the Americans and so on, and the floating, and there hasn't yet been time to get back onto that one. But I think that in these respects, the community is bound to move closer and closer together, and we shall certainly support it.
Well, he was right, wasn't he, Martin?
Well, it was. I mean, the ideas behind the European Union, when, as envisaged by the French and the German civil servants that set it up, was ultimately basically political union. There's no doubt about it.
And the single market was drawn up by...
Well, the single market was actually... A lot of the features of the single market were insisted on by Margaret Thatcher. She insisted on putting in loads and loads of free market stuff in there.
I did a bit of research into this a few years ago, and it was actually drawn up by employees of Philips Electronics.
Yes, of course. Of course, the single market... And of course, any trade deal you do...
It's actually the private sector that's designed it.
Of course, that's what happens. That's what trade deals are all about, Tony. The private sector, I'm afraid, dominates them. Yeah? The multinational corporations who dominate our society.
Basically, this argument is really about the fundamental bit in the argument, is whether Britain actually faces towards Europe and the social and liberal model, which Europe actually is overall, and protection against the multinationals, or whether we run off to Trump and go. And quite frankly, I know where I am. And I'm surprised, Tory, that you're actually on the Trump side.
Well, I'm not necessarily, so don't assume that. Anyway, so well, we'll hear a little bit more about that later. So let's have a listen now to back to the actual... Those two clips were from Ted Heath in 1973. Now, who, by the way, was accused 2 years ago, actually 18 months ago, by Mike Veal, the Chief Constable of Wiltshire, of being a child molester, abusing children sexually, and then he was moved up to Cleveland, and they effectively... sacked him from being Chief Constable of Wiltshire after he made that statement. But he certainly believed that Ted Heath had been interfering with young boys. But anyway, back on to 1975, where the Labour government under Harold Wilson effectively did the right thing and gave everybody a vote on the EEC. And here is David Dimbleby on Panorama speaking to two people in the very rancorously split Labour Party on the say no to the EEC side was Tony Benn, and on the yes side was Roy Jenkins.
Good Good evening. During the next 50 minutes, an opportunity to assess, through the differing views of two cabinet colleagues who disagree on this matter of supreme national importance, for and against Britain's remaining in Europe. I'd like to start, gentlemen, if I may, by asking you, since I think many people feel that the arguments for and against are very finely balanced, why it is that the two of you both feel so passionately about this issue. Mr. Benn.
Well, when all the economic and other arguments are melted away, I feel strongly about it because at bottom this erodes the importance of the vote for people in this country who don't have money or power in industry. It is the vote that is their main safeguard for the future. And common market membership devalues and downgrades the vote because it prevents people using the ballot box to adopt policies, change men who adopt policies and thus change taxes and laws. Because in future, if people vote yes on Thursday, then whatever the outcome of the general elections may be, much real power will rest in the hands of those who will not be affected by our elections. Now, there are men who give their lives for the right to self-government, independence, democracy. There are many men in the world today in prison for those rights. And we are being invited to give up those rights for whatever purposes we shall be discussing. And I think that makes this the most important point in British political history.
Mr. Jenkins.
Well, I think that Tony Benn has outlined the position extremely well, though I don't agree with his conclusion on it. Because I think that what the issue is about is how we can best control our destiny and exercise influence in the world. And I'm very anxious that we should be able to do that in Britain, and indeed that we should increase our influence. I think it's been diminishing too fast recently. But you see, I think there's grave danger of our getting bogged down in a debate about a theoretical paper sovereignty. I know from my own experience as a minister, and I believe Tony Benn does too, long before one went into the common market, when I was Chancellor of the Exchequer, that one is tremendously influenced by things which happen outside this country. And I think there's the most terrible danger of believing that because Parliament carries a resolution, it can influence what goes on. What I want is to see real British power and influence and control over our destiny, and I believe we can make that more effective by cooperating rather than by staying out on our
own. Staying out on our own. So what do you make of those? I mean, I find it fascinating that now we almost assume that this is a Tory party thing, that they have a big row about it, and also the Tories are in power as it's happening. Actually, as we went in, Labour was in power.
Yeah, well, if you think back to 1975, that was the oil price crisis has just happened, and of course it was before the Reagan-Thatcher revolution. When I went to interview at university in 1976, one of the questions I was asked by the economics department was, what do you understand by the term siege economy? Because in those days there were exchange controls, you couldn't take more than £1,000 out of the country without permission from the government. That's all gone. Because of the Thatcher-Reagan revolution, we've now, as Gary was saying earlier, if we don't cooperate on a European basis to get a social model that we can live with, the Americans are going to dictate to everybody, including us. And that's because of the changes that have taken place in society and economy in those years.
But is there still a split in the Labour Party, do you think? People who are anti-Brussels?
Oh, well, you can see the great problems we've got with that, because, you know, some Labour voters are pro-leave, as you well know, and but majority aren't. But, of course, we're not actually able to square that circle any more than the Tories are.
What do you make of that little blast from the past from 75, Gary?
Well, it's interesting, I claim. I think the anti-Europe thing is certainly at the moment driven by the far right. That's their agenda. But I think it's interesting that there are a few on the far left that do agree with them, but for completely different reasons. And I think that, you know, it's the people in the middle where the vast majority of the population want a quiet life. They want to know that they're protected against...
Yeah, but they don't want the United States of Europe, which is where this is heading.
Well, they don't want the United States even more.
Well, the United States of Europe could become another United States.
If we continue with our membership of the EU, and there was a con job pulled again by people saying, oh, but we wouldn't be allowed back in on the same terms. Oh, yes, we would. What's not clear and clear at the moment is if we have the unilateral power to extend Article 50 while we sort out a referendum. But basically, I know where I am, and I think the vast majority of the people are actually far more happy with the European model than the Trump model.
So do you think you'll get your no Brexit, or will it be a no deal?
I sincerely hope it will not be a no deal. I hope we'll get the second referendum. But who can say? Because there's so much, you know, cross-dressing going on in Parliament, and a lot of people are declaring their positions, which are not their real positions. So the Brexiteers, the Rees-Moggs of this world, they don't want Theresa May to come back with a slightly amended deal they'll vote for. They want out without any deal at all.
So we just heard from David Dimbleby in Panorama 1975. He's been going quite a while. He's also been doing the BBC's Question Time programme for 25 years. He's last night. So I thought I'd put a little compilation together of some of the best moments of the most recent BBC Question Time programmes, and we start with Will Self. Then we have Will Self pointing out that Boris Johnson actually pointing out that David Dimbleby was in the Bullingdon Club too, when Will Self brought it up. And then we have a clip from Mark Steele, and then the Daily Telegraph editor from last week's show, Charles Moore.
What really bothers me about Boris's Bullingdon pals, in particular George Osborne, his nickname, by the way, is Oi.
This spending review is a continuation of the strategy that the government has had ever since it came in, which has been to say the country is in debt and therefore we need to get money back. And who are we going to get the money back from? The poor. That's who. Yeah. It's the poor. It seems to be the belief of this government that the people with all the money in society are the poor. This is mainstream economics in this country now, is that the poor are richer than the rich, and therefore we have to get the money back from them. And I wonder what world you're in. The cuts that are happening, talking about people like firefighters, everywhere, fire stations shutting down. Were these the people who caused the debt? Firemen, were they the ones causing it? Running up bills of billions of pounds and gambling half the economy on the stock exchange in between fighting fires? I noticed there's a swimming pool in Newcastle that's been shut. Why on earth should it be the swimming pool in Newcastle that gets shut when it's the bankers that caused all this? It's about a culture that your government is managing to uphold, which is a culture to say that it's the poor to blame, and what we'll do is we'll make all the different sections of the people who aren't the rich, who didn't cause the crisis, all blame each other. We'll say, right, you're on benefit, so you're to blame. There is a very small minority of people who are richer than ever,
right.
And somehow you leave them alone.
Okay, thank you. At this time of great constitutional instability, when we all feel very uncomfortable, as we've been talking today, we do value continuity. And the only two things that are really have continuity in this country are Her Majesty the Queen and David Dimbleby. And, I'm so old that I even appeared on this programme before David ran it, with Robin Day, some of you will remember. And I think David's been a fantastic chairman. I should be very, very sad that we won't be seeing him anymore.
Well, it's very... This programme marks the end of my tenure of the chair. Thank you very, very much. I just wanted to add some words to that, which was to say that after a quarter of a century, I'm off to new pastors, or at least in search of new pastors. But I didn't want to end without saying something about this programme, which it is, of all the programmes ever worked in for the BBC, a team effort. And I did want to end by thanking the people who've made it possible over these last 25 years, the editors, the producers, the researchers, the directors, our technical backup, and a special thank you to our engine room, who've been here right through, Danny and Ali and Karen, who find the places we go to and select our audiences, which, as we know, with the political pressures on us, is not easy. But above all, I wanted to thank you here tonight, this audience. You're joining over 100,000 people in the last 25 years who've been in the Question Time audience and who've exercised this, what I think is a really important democratic right, to put questions to the panel and to argue with each other as you have been tonight. So I just want to thank you all, our audiences, both at home and here in the studios, very much. And so my thanks to tonight's panel. And Question Time, remember, Thursday, January the 10th, Fiona Bruce will be in the chair. I hope you'll join her then. From me, a happy Christmas, and not goodbye, but good night.
Will you miss it, Gary?
Not as much as I might have done 10 or 15 years ago. There's so many different places you get information, and nowadays...
Well, we want to see people like Martin on the panel, please. Martin, will you miss it? You don't even watch it, do you?
No, I won't miss it. I won't miss him.
What do you think of the choice of Fiona Bruce to take over, very, very briefly, in 5 seconds?
Well, we'll see, won't we?
Yes, I think that's probably the right answer.
Okay. That's now time for the Murdoch News at 7. We're back
Bristol
after the news.
BCFM,
looking
on
around the world
2.
At the world's hotspots.
And on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.